You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. 9.7 billion. That's how many people could be living on this planet by the year 2050. And we really don't know how we're going to feed them all. The problem isn't that we don't have enough food. The world's farmers currently produce enough to feed everyone on the planet, and then some. But we're not getting that food to the people who need it. The global food system is shaped by interests of wealthy countries and multinational corporations. And if it gets hit by a big enough disaster, like, say, a global pandemic, it starts to collapse. So this week, we look at two very different perspectives on how to sustainably feed a more crowded world. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
Like many sons of Brooklyn, I didn't see much growing while I was growing up. A few Italian neighbors lovingly protected fig trees to nurse them somehow through the New York winter. Some of my fellow apartment dwellers conjured up tomato plants from half-milk jugs on the fire escape. But to see food being grown, I had to go somewhere else. And a lucky life as a reporter has brought me to meet farmers in southern China, in beautiful Andean potato fields at 13,000 feet. I've been to cotton fields on the Nile, ridden in the cabs of enormous high-tech combines on corn and soybean farms in Iowa and Illinois. And I visited some of the poorest people on the planet in Lesotho in southern Africa. They were growing white asparagus for export to Germany and the Netherlands. What did I learn? The economics, science, design, fashion, fad, and flavor of what's gone into your mouth is incredibly complicated, and it's not easy to change because the long chains of relationships between farmers and markets and seed companies and inputs and middlemen put each in a global tug of war over food, and we, the eaters, are just holding on to one end of the rope. Raj Patel is trying to change that. He spent his career thinking about food. He's worked inside the system at the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. He says he's also been tear gassed on four continents protesting against those same organizations. His goal? To upend the global food system's troubling power dynamics.
The idea of food sovereignty comes from the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina. There are about 200 million farmers, farm workers, and landless people around the world who are part of this organization. And what they were saying was this. They were saying, look, in 1995, there was a big UN summit, and the summit was about food security. Food security is when you know that there's going to be enough food on the table that evening. But food sovereignty is about the power to shape the policies that get the food there in the first place. But in many ways, many of us live in a prison when it comes to thinking about food policy. It is made by large industrial corporations and the Congress people that they have bought. And those kinds of community-driven ideas around food sovereignty are really just a plea for democratic decision-making in our food policy-making process. Because one thing that's characterized food policy really for the past 500 years is it really hasn't been very democratic.
Patel's written many popular books, including Stuffed and Starved, and he co-hosts the podcast The Secret Ingredient. His most recent project is a new documentary film called The Ants and the Grasshopper. It was funded in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which also supports World Affairs. In the film, Patel and his co-director Zach Piper follow Anita Chitaya, a farmer and activist from Malawi who flies to the other side of the world to persuade Americans climate change is real. Do you want me to go to America to explain what's happening here? She asks in her native language, Chiwa. We know how to persuade people about big ideas. In the production of what is a beautiful film, The Ants and the Grasshopper, was there a moment where you just thought, this is it?
Well, thank you, Ray. I mean, I think one of those moments happened at the end of our 10 years of filming, where we had been working in Malawi and in the United States, talking to farmers there and here about climate change and about gender inequality. And for me, the moment that unlocked it for me and kind of broke my heart a little bit happens towards the end of the film, where someone in the United States, and I won't give too much away, but someone in the United States kind of reverses their position around climate change when they were confronted with our activists from Malawi and had time to think about it. That there's a sort of moment in the film where initially this farmer is a little reluctant to take on the ideas around climate change.
I think we'll see all them things again. I think it's kind of a cycle. I don't know.
Why do you say it's a cycle?
The history, I don't know. I think the last couple years we haven't had as much snow, but I think we'll get a lot of snow again. I don't know.
See, for me.
And our activists from Malawi say change begins with denial. And because he is so actively engaging in a debate around climate change, he'll be the first one to change. And they were quite right, and it only took 2 years.
People are destroyed because of a lack of knowledge. We have a lot of stuff polluting the atmosphere. That should not be. I'd like to apologize a little bit to the friends in Malawi. I laughed, but maybe I should have cried.
It was a beautiful moment, and I wondered when I saw him almost sheepishly admit that he now understands the whole thing better, whether you can imagine that at scale. 5,000 of those guys, 10,000 of those guys, 100,000 of those guys.
It's, I think, very interesting that the women who are able to change his mind and change his heart have an extensive background in doing exactly that at scale in Malawi. So for them, it wasn't surprising at all. And for them, it doesn't seem difficult to think of this as something that's scalable, because the exchange around climate change is one that had been prototyped in talking around gender inequality. A lot of the film shows that, you know, climate change seems like an impossibly big task to take on, but so does patriarchy. You know, the world in which you and I, Ray, have been born into is one in which we men have an unearned privilege. And the process of us recognizing that and then trying to do our level best to spend the rest of our lives getting rid of that privilege, you know, it's a big change. Now, what happened in Malawi, where these women and men were organizing, was that they figured out ways precisely to be able to get men to confront their patriarchy and then to do away with it. So for them, it's not surprising, and in fact, it is necessary and inevitable that ultimately everyone's going to come around to climate change. What it requires, though, is the kinds of skills of listening and persuasion that really ennoble and empower the intelligence that comes from people who live in communities and doesn't involve, you know, experts being flown in from around the world who talk posh like me and drop their wisdom and expertise and then you know, move on to the next village. It takes long, slow, patient, and dedicated change, and it works.
Well, the two women from Malawi visit huge, lush, well-resourced farms in the American Midwest, and they find that their fellow farmers are speaking to them across an enormous gulf of scale, of understanding, of lack of connection. They're all decent people, but it's tough for them to understand a woman who feeds a family from 1 acre of land. And the Malawians, for their part, laugh ruefully, almost in shock, when they calculate it would take them 30 years' income to buy the tractor parked in the barn.
$160,000, probably.
US dollars.
Yeah. Brand new.
Those resource inequalities were certainly part of the shock of coming to America. But perhaps, you know, the greater shock was quite how similar some of the situations and circumstances are. So, for example, we hear about farmers in the United States having these vastly expensive tractors. But these are the same farmers who will have a $1 million tractor in the barn and still be making $30,000 a year net, you know, and will be spend the rest of their life paying off debt. And there were moments of sort of connection and concordance between farmers in Malawi who also find themselves permanently, you know, indebted to seed suppliers or other purveyors of external inputs, and the kinds of experiences that US farmers have as well. And it's also very interesting, and I think this is something you'll be able to pick up on in the film, that not all farmers were baffled by their Malawian counterparts. It's certainly the case that some small farmers in the United States, particularly farmers of color, are quite familiar with the kinds of experiences of injustice that the Malawian farmers were up against. So I think that it was possible, despite these vast inequities in resources, for people to see one another through commonalities of experience, of being indebted and of being in the minority, particularly a small farmer in a country that very well-resourced large farmers seem to hold the sway of the government.
Malawi is not a country that's well-known, that has a brand in the United States. It is kind of in the southeast part of the continent. It's small. It's very crowded. It's very poor and already suffering the effects of climate change. And I think one of the hardest scenes to watch in the movie is when villagers are gathered around a dry riverbed and scooping sort of residual water out of the bed of this river. It's frightening, it's appalling, and very human at that moment.
And I mean, in some ways, that scene was a difficult one to include in the film because partly it sort of plays to expectations of desperate and impoverished Africans, you know, struggling with their circumstances. But the ways that Anita, who actively guided the ways that certain things appear in the film and certain things don't, one of the ways that was important for her to include, one of the reasons it was important for her to include that scene was because she wanted to make clear to, first of all, her friends in America that water shortage was a very real thing, but also that climate change affects women and men differently. Without this training around gender equality, it will sometimes be women who are in the front lines of climate change because they have to go and get the water in a patriarchal society. If those are the expectations, then it will be women's work to go fetch the water, and then they have to wait a very long time for the water to recharge, and then they have to come back and cook, and they have to clean, and they have to suffer the injustices of patriarchy all the more because of climate change. And that was a point that she was very keen for us to understand, and that's why it features in the film. So we didn't want merely to just, you know, sort of play to folks' understandings of Africa as desperately impoverished. We wanted to make the point that Anita was keen to make, which is that gender inequality makes everything worse.
Well, we see the dried out riverbed, and we also see the gushing, out of control, powerful Niagara that's formed when the rains fall all at once. So we know that there's water around, but it's just inopportune water. And water probably, I'm guessing, that takes away topsoil, that makes things even more difficult when it falls all at once.
That's right. And one of the ways that our friends in Malawi, through the Soils, Food and Healthy Communities Initiative, have figured that they can make climate change more survivable is by farming in ways that don't replicate the Midwest, insofar as they're not just planting a single crop and praying that the rain doesn't wash it away. You know, the Midwest is losing a great deal of topsoil, whereas in the agroecological methods that we see in Malawi, they are working with water contours on the land, they are intercropping, they are engaging in polyculture. All of these are practices that help build soil fertility and help build the structure of the soil to be able to withstand these increasingly severe extreme weather events. So I think, you know, you're right that in this moment, when we see the sort of torrents of water flowing down this previously dry riverbed, it, you know, it's possible to make the interpretation that things are just absolutely out of control. But it's also important to remember that, you know, farmers are smart, and they know that if this is going to be happening in a pattern again and again, we need to change our farming systems to adapt to it. And the kinds of farming systems that they've come up with and that they've experimented with involve crops from around the world. You know, you see a shot there of soy and of beans and of, you know, you see squash, and you see a range of different kinds of crops from the New World and from Asia, and they're all, you know, in the single garden working together to be able to maintain the soil fertility.
Your Malawians want to convince us of the interconnectedness of their world with ours, of the connection between people who are trying to wrestle a living out of the soil wherever they are on the planet. Angela tells her son that the pollution in one place in the world is actually going to affect every place in the world because it's one world. Can we, as individual American shoppers, put that connectedness into practice? Is it practical? Is it desirable to stand in a produce section, in a seafood section, and try to exert a measure of control over the marketplace through consumer choice? Can American customers encourage good practices, discourage bad ones, just through the way we use our dollars?
I don't think so, Ray. I mean, the way that we are encouraged to think about environmental change at the moment is, of course, you know, the sort of hyper-consumer American way, which is that we're often fed the lie that we can together transform the world by shopping. And there's just not a whole lot of evidence that that's going to be the case. You know, the amount of fair trade coffee, for example, is minuscule. It's around 1% of the market, I believe. The, you know, the changes that happen at the margins are precisely that. We're not altering the wholesale shape of the food industry when we go and buy something that is shade grown and, you know, dolphin friendly. Nonetheless, of course, you know, it's a good idea to be a smart consumer, because the opposite is to be a foolish consumer. No one wants that. But, you know, our shopping habits shouldn't make us believe that we have achieved something. Our shopping habits are a kind of promissory note. There's no number of Teslas that you can go out and buy that will solve the climate crisis. The changes that need to happen are changes that are about transforming government policy. And government policy won't change until we organize. And so essentially what the film is encouraging us to do, and what the film shows by example, is that you can get incredibly big changes, not by shopping differently, but by organizing collectively. And so one of the things that the film kind of encourages us to do is to flay from ourselves the idea that we are just shoppers. We've never just been shoppers. We were not born shoppers. We were born, you know, participants in communities, in families, in groups that are far more extensive than our individual wills can propel as we tootle around a shopping aisle.
So we're just end users in a long chain of relationships that we really exert no control over?
No. I think the argument is the opposite, that through our consent, often, a lot of bad things are happening. And one of the ways that we can stop bad things happening is by withdrawing our consent and by saying no and by teaching one another better. For example, you know, if we're thinking about how apartheid South Africa ended. Yes, there were, you know, orange boycotts and not buying South African this, that, and the other. But it wasn't through simply not buying bad things from South Africa. It was also through political pressure. It was also through protest. It was also through showing that things can and should be done differently. It was through political organizing and supporting the organizing that's happening, that was happening around the world and is happening now, for radical and transformative solutions that lift everyone up and that recognize equality. And those sorts of things we are not passive in, and we are ultimately very powerful in helping to address. And all we have to do is recognize the power that we've been taught to forget.
The population patterns underway in the world right now would indicate that by the middle of our current century, Africa is going to be one of the only places on the planet with growing populations, with a large set of cohorts of prime working age people, and hundreds of millions more mouths to feed. Does that mean that Africa inevitably is going to have to work toward almost industrial style agriculture, the way it's practiced in other places on the planet, rather than the smallholder agriculture that you see so often when you're there?
I certainly hope not, because what I would like is for Africa to, and for the, you know, for the entire planet, and for farmers around the world to move us towards a diet that is sustainable. Because what's abundantly clear is the planet doesn't have enough resources for, you know, for us to be able to consume sustainably. You know, if the entire planet were to consume the way that the United States does, we'd need seven planets. And we don't have seven planets. We've got just the one. So we need to start making choices about whether we in the United States are okay with consuming at a level that no one else can and we will not permit anyone else to, or whether we are prepared to make some changes here so that everyone can eat. And you know, the line that appears in the end of the film is that we need to live more simply so that others can simply live. Now, on top of that, we need to recognize that the footprint of the way that we consume in terms of dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico caused by runoff from the ways that we farm animals and through our use of chemicals and industrial agriculture, that footprint is vast and not sustainable. There is a way, however, farming which involves transforming the way we eat and transforming the range of our diet and our farming techniques towards diets that are far more sustainable, not only for the planet, but also healthier for us. Those kinds of diets are being experimented and being iterated and being researched by millions of farmers around the world. A recent study led by Professor Jules Pretty at the University of Essex found that 8 million farmer groups around the world, so there's not 8 million farmers, 8 million groups of farmers are busy experimenting with kinds of agriculture that are resilient to a world of climate change, so that when there are 8-9 billion people to feed, the kinds of agriculture that we have will not wreck the planet the ways that European and North American agriculture is already, denuding the soil and destroying the planet on which we live.
And what are you going to plant here?
I've got sorghum.
This is rice. It's called upland rice, so it grows in dry areas. And I brought it from my family's land in Trinidad.
Oh, there's more.
Later in the program, we're going to be hearing from Robert Parlberg, who says quite the opposite. He says that in a place like Africa, they're going to have to revolutionize what they do, change the inputs, change the scale, because right now, given the way that they're working, they won't be able to feed all those additional people. He says they've got to embrace genetically modified crops. They've got to use different inputs. They've got to take a look at large-scale agriculture as it's practiced in other places in the world, just to be able to keep up with demand. What do you say?
Well, I'm thinking of places that have tried that, and if we look to India, for example, that embraced precisely these tactics of hyper-industrialization, of irrigation, of adding inputs, of using hybrid varieties, of really bleeding-edge technology of the kind of the Green Revolution. You'll see that in the farmlands of Punjab, for example, they are in catastrophic water shortages. They're experiencing levels of farmer suicide and drug abuse in Punjab, in the very heart of the state in India that adopted the kinds of policies that Mr. Parlberg seems to celebrate. If you look at those places, you're seeing more and more of the people who originally celebrated these tactics, saying that what we need to do is shift to organic farming. And if those people who have lived the experiences of industrial agriculture and its technologies are saying, look what it's done to our soil, look what it's done to our people, look what it's done to our communities, you shouldn't do this. I'm wondering on what basis Mr. Paulberg believes that he is righter than the people who have suffered and lost family members in an agricultural policy that absolutely is guaranteed to require more energy, to require more fossil fuels, and to require more water, and ultimately is about less biodiversity. And in the middle of the sixth extinction, asking for less biodiversity seems rather foolish.
One of the things that changes when a country joins the rise of the rest that we've seen over the last half century is that one of the first things people want to do is eat more meat. It is stylish. It's desired. It's a display object, and it's satisfying. Can we talk people out of that?
Well, we don't have to, because throughout the European Union, a lot of countries have already hit peak meat. And that's to say that per capita red meat consumption is going down. And that's coming because of a number of realizations. In part, the realization that as much red meat as people consume in Europe might not be the best for your health. And we have more and more evidence to suggest that certainly highly processed meat is a known carcinogen, at least according to the International Association of Cancer Researchers. And we also have information around people wanting to go green in their diet. And so for more and more countries outside the United States, but rich countries where people's income go up, the amount of meat that's being consumed is going down. Now, you're quite right to observe that there are lots of countries where that sort of meat consumption isn't happening. But as more and more income, as more and more people get the income, I think that one of the things to do is certainly regulate the meat industry. And then the other thing to do is to recognize that, for example, in India, no matter how rich people are getting, no matter how rich Hindus get, for example, no one's going to persuade them to eat a beef burger. There are cultural reasons why there are certain kinds of meat consumption that are not going to happen. And those cultural reasons can change, they can spread. And I certainly think that there are ways in which by leading by example, and I'm not thinking of the United States here, but I am thinking about the other advanced industrial countries of the world where perhaps there is more reasoned debate than we're able to see here in the United States. You're seeing declining levels of meat consumption as countries do lead by example and reduce their meat consumption.
Well, I was thinking when I asked the question about China, which when I'm visiting China, I always am shocked at the number of McDonald's that are there. And instead of being old hat, as McDonald's and chains like it penetrate into more and more distant provincial cities and smaller towns, you replicate that process where somebody who's making a couple of more yuan a week now figures they can treat themselves to a Big Mac and a envelope of fries and a soft drink. And we're talking about a couple of hundred million people that world commerce is licking their lips, thinking about getting them, not only beef, but also pork and other meats.
And isn't it interesting that the example that you use there, Ray, is McDonald's? McDonald's is not a natural phenomenon. Sometimes we hear that there's just something normal about being richer and then wanting to consume more meat. But McDonald's is a marketing empire. There is a great deal of money being spent to persuade people to part with their income towards foods that are obesogenic, that are possibly carcinogenic, and are certainly bad for the planet in the ways that they're being produced at the moment. Now, if there were an economic system that recognized the external costs that this kind of industrial agriculture provided, and the general feeling at the moment is that we pay about a third of the full environmental and social cost of our food, then perhaps we would recognize that the real cost of certainly the industrial agricultural food that we're consuming in the United States is vastly subsidized by people's ill health and by prejudicing the future of the planet. So I certainly think that there are ways in which we We desperately need a change in the way that our food system is governed. And this gets us back to the film. I mean, this is not the kind of change that you can shop for, not the sort of change that you can stick a price label on something and assume that everything's going to go okay. This is the kind of change that involves decent and dignified conversations between the people who suffer the consequences of this kind of consumption and the people who enjoy its benefits. And the good news is that I think it is possible for the people who are privileged to recognize their own privilege and do something about it.
The world has changed a lot over the past year and change. Can you describe the impact of the pandemic on global food systems? I know that at points during the past year, it was easy to feel hopeless. Is it easy to feel hopeful? Are there reasons for encouragement given the way things happened over the past year?
Unfortunately, Ray, because so much of the world is still in the pandemic and will still be in the pandemic until at least next year, it's hard to look for these rays of hope. I mean, yes, there were moments at the beginning of the pandemic, for example, where the supply chains that were the most robust were not the industrial supply chains, but the local ones, the ones that were more about urban and peri-urban farming. And those farmers I know have been incredibly busy managing the increased demand for, you know, community-supported agriculture initiatives. But unfortunately, the overall architecture of the food system has kind of remained the same, you know, through the pandemic. Look at who it was that managed to get dispensations for essential personnel. It was, of course, you know, the meat industry was able to continue its slaughter operations and, you know, do its work as being a sort of hotspot for COVID throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. So, and I worry now about the increase in food prices and global food price inflation in a time where, as I say, much of the global economy, many of the poorest people are still struggling with COVID and its economic aftermath. And when food prices rise and incomes for the poorest remain the same or fall, then you're headed for a very dark season of hunger indeed. So unfortunately, I'm not seeing the structural shifts happening in ways that are consonant with the eradication of hunger by 2030, which is a sort of stated UN goal. And I'm not seeing the sort of shifts towards regenerative agriculture at the state level that I would like to see. But I am seeing more and more people in conversation about agroecology and around the possibilities of shifting our subsidy system away from a toxic and planet-destroying agriculture to one in which everyone gets to be able to have support to transition towards more survivable and carbon-sequestering agriculture.
Raj Patel co-hosts The Secret Ingredient, a podcast about food politics. I really do want you to search out his recent documentary, The Ants and the Grasshopper. You won't be sorry when you watch it. Raj Patel, great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Ray, for the conversation.
You're listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Ray Suarez. If you want to hear more of our stories from around the world, you can check out our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The way Raj Patel sees it, industrialized corporate agriculture poses an urgent threat to the future of our planet. But our next guest sees it very differently.
You have to constantly be putting yourself in the position of people outside the advanced industrial world, I think, to get a full picture of what's at stake when a new technology is as completely rejected as GMO food crops have been.
That's Robert Parlberg. He spent years researching international food policy, and he thinks corporate agriculture is an essential part of our lives. He questions a lot of the conventional rhetoric around sustainable food systems, from the push to buy organic to the fear surrounding GMOs. Parlberg has been a consultant to USAID and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's also a former biotech advisor to Monsanto's CEO. His latest book is Resetting the Table: Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat. he decided to write his book after attending an event about sustainable food at Harvard. As he describes it, the panel consisted of a celebrity chef, a playwright, and the leader of the slow food movement.
And they all reached a judgment that sustainable food would have to be organic, local, and slow. And those are popular beliefs. But I had just returned from a research trip to rural Africa where I'd been interviewing Ugandan farmers. And I knew that they were already living in a world that was de facto organic, local, and slow. And it wasn't good for them or for their children. They didn't know it. They were living the Harvard dream, but they were impoverished and their children were frequently undernourished. So I decided to write a book that would push back against some of these popular notions.
Pretty much right out of the gate, you throw down the gauntlet to your reader and defend so-called industrial farming. So let's start there. On a big spread where commodity crops are grown, you can see them throughout the Midwest. Those are sort of the bad boys of American farming. But what's gone right about the way Americans produce food?
Well, you have to keep in mind the quantity of food that the market now demands and the increased quantity of food that we're producing today compared to the 1930s and the 1940s before we had an industrial farming system. We're producing three times as much agricultural products in the United States today as we were in 1940. If we had tried to produce that much using the traditional methods of the 1930s and the 1940s, we would have done far greater damage to the environment. Already in the 1930s, we'd reached the limits of what traditional agriculture could provide. We'd expanded cropping into the drought-prone southern plains. And when we had a drought, the soil blew away and we created a disastrous dust bowl. Fortunately, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and right up through the current day, we've introduced a number of technical innovations in agriculture that have reduced our dependence on land, on water, on chemicals, on energy, and of course on labor as well. People don't realize it, but all that corn you see when you drive through the Midwest, we're producing five times as much corn now as we did in 1940, but on 20% less land. We're using technology to increase yields on the land that's already been plowed so that we don't have to plow more. Compared to four decades ago, we're consuming 18% less pesticides. Compared to 1972, we're applying more than 80% fewer insecticides. Energy use on farms is way down since we've gone to no-till farming. We don't have to burn as much diesel fuel. If we hadn't introduced these industrial-scale innovations, it would have been impossible to produce the food that the market has demanded without doing much more damage to the environment.
Well, you and I are both old enough to remember when you just couldn't eat certain things during certain times of year, and you might even look forward to a certain time of year because you associated them with the availability of some well-loved fruits. Whenever I'm in a supermarket now and I pick up a plum in January and I see a sticker on it that says that it came from Chile, you know, I have to think twice and sometimes a third time about the efficiencies of a farmer on the west side of the Andes with a plum tree, getting his plum somehow to Valparaiso, I guess, which is the seaport, and then that boat going 12,000 miles to a port on the west coast of the United States, and then that plum getting on a truck or maybe even, if it's a high-priced plum, a plane. Does it really make any sense? Wouldn't it have been okay for me to just wait till June to have the darn plum?
Well, Americans don't eat enough fresh fruits and vegetables. If you didn't allow us to import these very healthy products, particularly off-season, America's diet would be worse than it is already. We don't eat enough of these products. If you tried to grow them all in the United States, the price would be so high that our consumption of these products would go down and our diet would be worse than it is. I don't think we should be anxious about the fact that food travels a long distance. If it travels by ocean freight in a refrigerated container, for every single plum that we get, the carbon footprint is minuscule. It's not how far food travels that determines its carbon footprint. It's the mode of travel. We've found better ways to get fresh, nutritious products to consumers in parts of the country that don't have the year-round sunshine, that don't have the labor force that the Central Valley has in California. And the example from my part of the country is asparagus. I'm in Massachusetts, and the Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts used to be known as the asparagus capital of the world because they had perfect, well-drained, sandy soil. Asparagus, not only for the city of Boston, but for much of the east coast of the United States, was being grown in the Pioneer Valley. Well, the sandy soil is still there, but no one's growing asparagus in western Massachusetts anymore because asparagus, it's a perennial crop, and the shoots pop up at different times, and it has to be hand harvested. It has to be hand cut. You can't mechanize the harvest. And that means stoop labor. That means punishing stoop labor. And wages in western Massachusetts just keep going up and up and up and up. And so the asparagus growers left Massachusetts. Many of them are now in Central and South America, where you can still find people who are willing to do that very hard work at an acceptable price. Now, you could probably write a novel about the justice or injustice of that outcome, but in the end, in Boston, I get asparagus. I wouldn't otherwise.
Your thesis in the book is more challenging and more difficult than I've made out so far. So let's grasp some of the various nettles that you've laid out for us and go back to Africa, because Africa is organic, local, and slow, and has had in recent years challenges. It's one of the last places in the world where people still have large families. It is one of the few places in the world that will have a sizable peak strength and vitality time of life labor force in mid-century, one of the last places on earth where there'll be a big, big labor pool of people in their 20s and 30s in mid-century, and a place that's had trouble feeding itself. Now there are 1.25 billion people on the African continent, and a lot of the food they eat day in and day out is imported. It must be, because of the agriculture that's practiced there. So how can we prescribe organic and local for ourselves and want something different for Africa?
Well, that's the question I opened my book with, in a sense. African agriculture is essentially unimproved. African smallholder farmers don't have any of the things that farmers in the rest of the world have used to make their labor more productive, increase their income, and escape poverty. African smallholder farmers don't have access to fertilizer. They seldom have access to improved seeds. They don't have veterinary medicine for their animals. They don't have irrigation. They don't have electricity. They don't have mechanical power. For the most part, they don't have these things because they're essentially cut off from the modern economy by an inadequate rural infrastructure. Most African farm households live more than 2 kilometers from the nearest all-weather road. So in the rainy season, they can't take their goods out to the market, and they can't bring fertilizer and seeds in to plant for the next season. They're sealed off from prosperity. They're forced to produce much of their own food. In Ethiopia, poor rural households produce 60% the food that they consume themselves. Oh, this sounds wonderfully self-sufficient, but their productivity is so low, they have to work all day long to do this, which means they don't have time to do anything else, to make money doing anything else, and so they're in a perfect poverty trap. We need to understand that farmers in the rest of the world were fortunate when their governments created a rural infrastructure of all-weather roads, when their governments put in rural electricity, when their governments invested in irrigation projects. Governments in Africa haven't done this. Governments in Africa, unfortunately, lavish all of their resources onto urban dwellers and leave the countryside, for the most part, neglected. And until that, in India in the 1970s, when that country started making large investments in agriculture and had considerable success, it was devoting 20% of its total public budget to agriculture. In Africa today, most governments devote less than 5% of their public budget to agriculture, even though 50 to 60 to 70% of their citizens depend on farming and herding cattle for income and employment.
It is a hard thing to be a farmer in Africa, whether you're growing for the marketplace or just for your family. But even those farmers who try to climb a couple of rungs up the ladder have some structural challenges that are not easily gotten around. Credit is a difficult road for a lot of African families, and they are sort of strung out from loan to loan. They live from loan to loan for inputs, for seed, and it's very hard for them to get ahead. Land tenure is very difficult in many places in Africa. So you can't even use your land as collateral to get any of the other things, either in equipment or in inputs that you really need. It's scary to think about what another half a billion people might eat in another 40 years there. Will that need sort of force the change just because there's no choice?
Well, that's a good question. The additional dimension here that has to be acknowledged is that most African farmers are women, and they may not have authority to make decisions on the farm because the property rights are all in the hands of men. They may have to wait until their husband returns from the market town where he's found a better way to make money in order to make a decision to cut down a tree or to slaughter a goat. They just simply don't have the authority that's needed to make productive decisions on the farm because of their subordinate legal status. Those are things that should be changed as well.
One of the most irritating arguments that swirled around cultivators in the developing world has to do with genetically modified organisms, so-called GMOs. If they grow them and get better yields, they really do have to stay close to home because export markets won't buy what they produce. When growers in developing countries use GMO crops, they'll find a lot of markets close to them, even as an additive or an ingredient in food that winds up being processed and used for other purposes. Yet, GMOs make it possible for the hundreds of millions across the developing world to be more secure, to be sure that they're going to have enough to eat every day. It's a real conundrum.
Yeah, the regulation of GMOs is a fascinating problem. And what I find most fascinating about it is that most countries in the developing world have not yet made it legal for their farmers to plant any genetically modified seeds for basic food staple commodities. Nowhere in the developing world, in fact, nowhere in the world, is it legal for farmers to plant GMO varieties of wheat. Nowhere is it legal for farmers to plant GMO varieties of rice. The two most important staple crops in the world are not being grown commercially anywhere in a GMO form because governments have adopted regulatory systems that make this against the law. This is something that surprises people. They've been told that GMOs promoted by powerful biotechnology companies are being forced down the throats of farmers and people in the developing world, but this is actually an interesting case in which the campaigns against these companies and against GMOs have won a spectacular victory when it comes to food crops for direct human consumption. Now, a lot of GMO crops are grown in much of the Western Hemisphere for animal feed or for industrial purposes like cotton or or yellow maize, yellow corn that's turned into ethanol for auto fuel. But GMOs for direct human food consumption, there practically aren't any being grown anywhere. A little bit of papaya in Hawaii, a little bit of white corn in the Republic of South Africa, some sugar beets, but otherwise, almost nothing.
I wonder if GMOs would have a better time if we could have a better conversation about what is and what isn't. People make distinctions. If a form of tough grass that grows in arid lands, drought resistant, is spliced into a variety of wheat to help it grow in areas with increasingly unreliable rains, people look at that differently from pulling a gene that keeps fish from freezing solid in Arctic waters and putting it in strawberries so that you can grow them in the snow. I think there's a more subtle, more nuanced conversation to be had around GMOs. Just everything we eat is pretty much not a plant that occurred in this natural state that we're eating it in originally. Everything's been modified over time to become a commercial food crop. There's no wild cow that we could go hunt and put in a pen and then eventually turn into steak. There is no wild pig that resembles anything like the pig that you'll find in a big hog operation in Iowa. Those have been genetically modified for eons.
Even wild onions don't exist anymore. They're extinct. So, no, you're exactly right. Opposition to GMO foods, I think, is best explained by noticing that the benefits of this technology were intended for farmers. The first generation of GMO crops that came on the market were designed to give farmers a chance to reduce their costs by reducing what they had to spend on insecticide sprays and by reducing the number of herbicide sprays they had to use. It was a way to protect crops against weeds and insects at lower cost to farmers. But there was no benefit, practically no benefit at all, for consumers, the end user. Genetically modified soybeans didn't taste any better. They didn't prepare any better. They weren't any more nutritious. And they weren't noticeably cheaper by the time the soybean oil was mixed into a product on the shelf. The slightly lower price of the GMO soybean that had been harvested was lost completely. So consumers saw no benefit, and this meant that it was easy for critics of GMOs to persuade them to reject the product. I contrast this to the use of genetic engineering in medicine, where the same recombinant DNA technology was being used at about the same time in the 1990s to produce a wide array of new biologic drugs. They were manufactured using the genetically modified ovary cells of Chinese hamsters. You'd think that that would have an ugh factor for consumers, but no, because these are pharmaceutical products that delivered important and direct benefits to the final consumer. If you're getting a benefit, you're not going to be quite as nervous about the novelty of a product. If you're not getting a noticeable benefit, a novel product can seem much more anxiety-inducing.
You talk about the campaigns against genetically modified food and about the lack of evidence for their harm. But, you know, I think some of the resistance to GMOs is not assuaged. It's not addressed. It's not handled. It's just sort of dismissed, and that's a problem. If you say, well, look, there's no proof that these things do you any harm. They actually do a lot of good, so leave me alone. That's one answer. Another answer might be, look, we'll segregate these crops and we will work our way through and we'll talk you through and the industry will adapt and help start a dialogue with eaters and buyers of these things.
Yeah, one question that occurs to me when I look at this problem is, who should be determining the outcome? I mentioned that when it comes to GMO food crops, the companies that tried to put them on the market have essentially failed completely because of resistance from consumers in industrial countries, beginning in Europe, but in many other industrial countries as well. Those countries put stifling regulations in place, and developing countries adopted the same regulations, thinking that was the best practice. So now these crops are not in the field anywhere. But if you're one of those maize farmers in Africa, and if your crop is being destroyed by stem borers, and if you had BT maize, you could control those insects without any insecticide sprays. Maybe you've lost something here when it's not legal for you to plant that crop. Or let's say you're a child in Bangladesh and you are not getting enough beta carotene, and you run the risk of a vitamin A deficiency blindness. The fact that a vitamin A rich variety of rice known as golden rice has been sitting on the shelf for 20 years because it's not legal to grow anywhere because it's a GMO. Maybe you have an interest in that.
Is this a salvageable proposition? You're talking about these wonderful developments that are bottled up in effect. Right now, it's a valor to put no GMOs on your packaging, to promise that there are no genetically modified organisms in the things you sell. How can we unleash these advances, but in a way that's responsible and builds confidence and builds market instead of feels like it's being shoved onto the buying public?
Yeah, if you'd asked me that question 3 years ago, I would have said, well, it's too late for GMOs. Recombinant DNA technologies, bringing genetic traits in from unrelated species, the opposition to that is so complete, we shouldn't try to reverse that social judgment. I would have said, fortunately, we have a next generation of new crop biotechnologies that don't bring in foreign genes from unrelated species. It's called gene editing. These crops are called CRISPR crops. It's a biotechnology method that mimics natural mutations that take place all the time in plants and animals. You can, with considerable precision, either edit out or up-influence genetic traits with enormous precision using this technology. It was first done in 2012, I think, in the laboratory. And it's much less expensive than recombinant DNA technologies. It's far more precise. So these new gene-edited crops will have to be approved one at a time. They will have to be segregated in the marketplace from non-gene-edited crops. There'll have to be an audit trail. The operators in the marketplace that handle these crops will have to keep a record for 5 years of every gene-edited crop they got and from whom and to whom they sold it and when. These are the stifling regulatory requirements that drove GMOs out of the marketplace completely. And so now there's a chance that gene-edited crops are going to be driven out of the market as well. So we may have only seen the first act in a two-part drama of whether the world is ready for modern crop biotechnology. It may not be, and I think we would lose something in that result.
Robert Pauerberg's new book is Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED with funding from TPG and First Republic Bank. Additional support is provided by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is working alongside others to build a culture of health for everyone in America, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? Do you have ideas for future stories? Please email us at feedback@worldaffairs.org. Our production team includes Teresa Katsourilis, Matteo Schimpf, Elise Manoukian, and Jared Sport. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Tatum Senderbeck manages our website. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.